Timothy Geglein was for nearly 7 years, most of the George W. Bush administration, the director of Office of Public Liaison for the White House under George W. Bush. Karl Rove describes him as the man in the middle, and that becomes the title of Tim Geglein's new book, An Inside Account of Faith and Politics in the George W. Bush Era. Tim Geglein is now vice president of external relations for Focus on the Family, and as stated, previously served as deputy director of the White House Office of Public Liaison under President George W. Bush. And Tim, it is an honor to welcome you here to the Paul Edwards Program.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
Let's get the opening chapter out of the way. A scandal forces you to resign. Talk about that scandal and the aftermath.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate being on the program and telling people about my book, The Man in the Middle, because there's no more important chapter in this entire book than the first one. I can tell you, Paul, that as I write in the book, I had the job of my dreams. I loved working for George W. Bush. I was indeed his key contact person to all my fellow conservatives and the faith community. It was really the role of a lifetime, and I was one of President Bush's longest-serving aides. I'm very sorry to report that Potomac fever is a real thing, and I had a very bad strain of it. And the strain that I had is pride. And, you know, pride takes a lot of avenues. It can take the avenue of sex. It can take the avenue of power. It can take the avenue of money. And in my particular avenue, my particular strain was real vanity and pride, was always wanting to be the one who said it better than anyone and was clever in that regard. A very good friend of mine, Bill Buckley, who is now deceased, about whom I write at length in the book, once said it's a remarkable thing to be sitting in the Oval Office and to realize that the leader of the free world is taking notes while you're speaking. Mm. And this really points to the question of pride and vanity. And I began plagiarizing columns for my hometown newspaper. I knew exactly what I was doing. It wasn't pressure. It wasn't stress. It wasn't extenuating circumstances. I was being deceptive. And I came back one day from a breakfast at the White House, and a reporter sent me an email and asked me, is it true? And as I recount in the book, I literally fell next to my desk in the White House, and I just prayed, oh, God, because I knew it was true. And I knew that I would resign that day in my shame and in my humiliation, which I did. At this point, I had inflicted incredible embarrassment on the president, who had invested so much in me, as had great colleagues and mentors, not to mention the most important people in my life, my wife and children. And you know, Paul, in the political classes, when you embarrass the president, there's a kind of divorce that takes place. You immediately become persona non grata, and you are totally cut off, and that's what I expected to happen to me. And this all happened on a Friday, and when I came into the White House Monday, having resigned, I began to take the pictures off my wall and clean out my desk, and the chief of staff said that the boss, meaning the president, wanted to see me, and I knew this was going to be my woodshed moment and that I deserved it. And I went to the Oval Office, and I shut the door, and it was just the president and me. And I turned to President Bush, and I looked him in the eyes to apologize, and before I could get a few words out, as I recount in my book, he looked at me and he said, I forgive you. And I was totally stunned. And I turned to him and I tried a second time to apologize. And again, I barely got a few words out. And he looked at me again and he said, grace and mercy are real. He said, I've known them in my life and I'm extending grace and mercy to you. And I finally apologized to him. I said, you know, he should have taken me by the lapels and thrown me into Pennsylvania Avenue for what I had done. And I'll tell you, Paul, a third time, as I recount in The Man in the Middle, he looked at me right in the eyes and he said, I'll say again, forgiveness is real, grace and mercy are real, I'm extending it to you. He said, we can talk all about this for the next few minutes, or we can talk about the last 8 years.
Mm.
And he asked me to sit in a place of honor in the Oval Office, and I was stunned. And I thought this was the last time I would ever see him. And I spent about 20 minutes with him, and we hugged and embraced, and we prayed together, And as I was leaving, as I recount in the book, he turned to me one last time and he said, and by the way, I want you to bring your wife and your boys here so that I can tell them what a great husband and father you have been. And by this time, I was nearly in tears. I couldn't believe it. The leader of the free world did not need to do what he was doing. And I'll tell you, it does not happen in any U.S. presidency. But I think it goes to the heart of who George W. Bush is. And so in the worst moment of my life, all of my own fault, all of my own making, as I recount in The Man in the Middle, at the absolute bottom of my life, George W. Bush extended grace, mercy, love, and forgiveness to me. And I have never known such forgiveness and such a sense of grace as I knew in that moment.
Timothy Gegline, my guest. He's the author of The Man in the Middle, an inside account of faith and politics in the George W. Bush era. He served as a deputy director of the White House Office of Public Liaison under President Bush, and he's currently vice president of external relations for Focus on the Family. I have to tell you, Tim, I read that chapter of your book again the second time. I read it the first time when I got your book about a week or so ago. And when I read the first chapter, I cried then, and then I had it in my office today, and I picked it up, and I reread that first chapter again, and I cried again. And, you know, I'm thinking, what is it about this man, this president, you know, the most powerful man in the world, the leader of the free world? He certainly doesn't have to extend grace in this way. He certainly doesn't have to invite you to the Oval Office. There are a lot of people, both conservative and liberal, both Democrat and Republican, who think that George W. Bush is not the real deal. What can you say to them to say, that's just not true, he really is the real deal?
Well, he really is the real deal, and that is one of the major reasons that I wrote this book, Paul. The subtitle is Faith and Politics in the George W. Bush Era, and Everything Old is New Again. I can honestly say that as we head into 2012, faith and politics are yet again intertwining, which I think is a good thing, by the way. Mm-hmm. But I have to tell you that elementally, it's impossible to understand who George W. Bush is, who his character and integrity are, without understanding at bottom that he is a very serious Christian. And I've worked and lived in the Beltway and around the Beltway for nearly a quarter of a century. I've walked with all the princes of this world. I worked for 10 years in the U.S. Senate. It's been a rather, you know, and I say this with humility, it's been a remarkable professional experience. But I can count on one hand the number of men or women I've met who are the same in private as they are in public. And, you know, George W. Bush is in a great tradition, but a rare tradition, because our founding fathers said that the thing that we wanted most in our presidents was virtue. And by that, they meant moral excellence. And that's who George W. Bush is. He has an internal moral compass. He has a great soul, and he knows who he is. He's extremely confident. He's a natural-born leader. And I have to tell you, to your first point, Paul, I feel very confident that people can buy stock in the Bush presidency because it will rise over time. Not 100 years from now or even 50 years from now, but we're already seeing that the policies that he put in place after 9/11, which Charles Krauthammer has called, you know, the Pearl Harbor of our generation, George W. Bush's greatest achievement is that he kept us safe on our domestic soil for all 7 years after the terrible attacks of 9/11. And in the book, I write about being in the White House on 9/11 in my chapter "Lightning Out of a Clear Blue Sky." And I watched this man become president. He went from a peace and prosperity president to one of a handful of war presidents, and that's when you really see a man's character and integrity. And it was large.
What were, Tim, some of the big battles that were being fought on the social front, the cultural front, by this president while you were there in the White House?
Well, Paul, he is the most, without equal, in the contemporary presidency. He is the most pro-family, pro-life, pro-marriage, pro-religious liberty president we've ever had, without exception. On small things and on very large things, George W. Bush was categorically a social conservative and categorically reliable on all of these matters that go to the question of morality and social cohesion and health in our great country. But I can tell you, and I write about this again at length in The Man in the Middle, and this is one of the reasons I want people to read the book, because, you know, for the limited number of books that have come out, there have been none that have really taken people directly inside the Supreme Court battles that President Bush led. And I can honestly say that if you want to pick out the number one contentious time, you know, beside the war and beside the, you know, TARP and stimulus battles at the end of the administration, I can honestly say that it's easy to forget the very big battle over who would become the Chief Justice of the United States. And that, of course, turned out to be John Roberts, who would turn out to be another Associate Justice, and that turned out to be Samuel Alito. 35% of all sitting federal judges were nominated and confirmed under George W. Bush. These are really big things. None bigger than the war, to be sure. None bigger, than national security. But I can honestly say that on the social front, on the domestic front, George W. Bush did well. He chose well. And I think it's fair to say that the domestic legacy of any president is almost always defined by how they shaped and molded the Supreme Court. Because even though there's only 9 people on the Supreme Court, each and every one of their decisions impacts immediately over 300 million lives of the people who are all citizens of the United States. So George W. Bush did well by us and by the country.
There are a lot of social conservatives that are going to look at the Bush administration and to even the Reagan administration and other conservative presidents and say, look, we elected Ronald Reagan, we elected George H.W. Bush, we elected George W. Bush so that we could stem the tide of the social decline, the moral decline of this nation in the area of abortion, in the area of gay rights, the homosexual activist agenda. And yet here we are in the beginning of the second decade of the 21st century, having gone through three conservative presidents, at least conservative on the social side, the moral side of things, and nothing much, it seems, on the surface of things, Tim, has changed in those regards. Abortion is still happening. More states are now considering and legalizing civil unions and gay partnerships, gay marriages. As someone who was on the inside in the White House and now where you sit at Focus on the Family, are we misreading the effectiveness of these presidents in terms of their social agendas?
That is a absolutely brilliant question, and I want to go to the heart of it because it goes to the heart of the reason that I wrote the book. I believe that politics is very important. And I know that there are a lot of young people listening. We've never needed young, bright, smart people in government more than now. And I hope that if people are listening and determining, you know, what should I do with my life, that they will spend part of it in public service, because I think public service can be a very noble calling. That having been said, politics is downstream from culture. Culture is preeminent. Culture is what forms and shapes and ultimately impacts the nature and flow of a great country, culture, and civilization like ours. And politics cannot fix it. Politics can make it worse. And we have literally thousands of examples of where government has made things worse. But we cannot look, ultimately, in my opinion, to any single president or senator or representative or governor to fix it. The fixing part must take place in the social fabric, which begins in what George W. Bush called the unseen pillar of civilization. And that unseen pillar of civilization is the strong, healthy, flourishing nuclear family. If you show me a strong nuclear family, I'll show you a strong country. I'll show you a country which has a strong moral and social fabric and civil society. But show me a country where you have fractured and broken families, fractured and broken marriages, and I'll show you a fractured and broken country. Mm. And I have to tell you, that's the reason, Paul, why having spent a good part of my professional life in government, love serving in the Senate, love serving in the White House, that I've decided to come to Focus on the Family. Because at Focus on the Family, families, marriages, and parenting are our bullseye. They're at the center. And we realize that we're making a cultural contribution when we help keep the family intact, when we help people in crisis. That's why I love Focus on the Family. You know, it's a ministry that if it didn't exist, we'd have to create it. It's that important. But I'm so pleased you asked this question because so many people, fellow Christians and conservatives, are very discouraged. They look at the political scene, they look at the economy, and they you know, throw their proverbial hands in the air. But I do not share that sense of pessimism, and I'm a conservative and a Christian in good standing. In fact, I chose to write in the last chapter of my book a chapter called Toward an American Renaissance, a Rebirth, because I believe that our best days are ahead. I think we're going through a bad patch, but I think our best days are ahead. But in my opinion, Paul, those best days coming ahead will not be formed in government. They will be formed in the social fabric of our country, and there's a lot of good signs.
Every man leaves who serves as president of the United States obviously has an effect for good or ill, and maybe in some cases both, on the direction of the country socially, economically, politically. From your perch inside the White House, let's lay aside the legacy of George W. Bush politically, and every man also that occupies that office affects the presidency in some way. How is the presidency, if you can answer this question, it might be a little too esoteric, but how is the presidency, Tim, different today because George W. Bush was president?
Again, a brilliant question. You know, I'm going to use the word great. And when I say great, I don't mean ideologically. I know there are people I'm going to name some presidents, and they're going to say, why would he say he's great? I don't mean great as in, you know, but I mean foundational for the country. But if you look at the truly great presidents of the country, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, you know, as far as the war presidency and the way he conducted it, Franklin Roosevelt in World War II, Ronald Reagan, the thing that these presidents have in common is that they were so foundational, so monumental to the ebb and flow of the direction of America, that every single president who came after them could not go around the large demarcation and changes that they left behind. Say what you want about the Gettysburg Address. Say what you want about the Civil War. But every president who came afterward had to deal with Lincoln's decisions, the same in the decisions of the Revolutionary War and the founding of the country under George Washington, the same for the explosion of big government as a result of all of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal programs, but also as a result of the impact of World War II on America. Every president leaves behind some kind of a demarcation, whether it's legislation, whether it's a change in the composition of the federal government, whether it is personnel as policy, and I believe that the biggest thing, domestic legacy, that George Bush left behind was the Supreme Court. John Roberts and Sam Alito, combined with Scalia and Thomas, who are already there, these four men form in the history of the Supreme Court four of the most important conservatives ever to serve on that court. In security policy, the Department of Homeland Security and the reconfiguration of our military and defense capability to respond to radical jihadism, nuclear proliferation, and the great new era after 9/11 that was thrust upon our country, those are also Bush legacies. So these are very, very tectonic changes. And I believe that for presidents to come, they will have to deal with the composition of the Supreme Court. They'll have to deal with the Homeland Security ramifications that George W. Bush put down. But one final comment very briefly, and I think this is the most important thing I can say about the man in the middle. I believe that in my book, I evoke the character and nature of our 43rd president. I came to see, Paul, that there are all kinds of senior people who write books, but they're so close to the power that they miss things. Mm. And there are people like me who were not the senior most person, who were not the most confidant, you know, the president, but we saw things. And, you know, I spent a lot of time at close range with George W. Bush. And my conclusion is that he was a gifted and remarkable leader. His yes was yes and his no was no. He had a spine of steel. And I believe, above all, that he believed that America was an exceptional, exemplary country and the leader of the free world that really had special duties and obligations in the first part of the 21st century. That goes to the heart of what we should remember legacy-wise, in my opinion, about the Bush years.
Oh, absolutely. And every time we see him sitting behind the on-deck circle at a home game at the ballpark in Arlington, every American, many Americans that I know, long for the day that he was sitting behind the desk in the Oval Office. You can't see the man without evoking exactly what you've described him as being. Earlier in this conversation, Tim, you said that that President George W. Bush is one of the few people that you know who is the same in private as he is in public. About 2 years ago now, I was at a Heritage Foundation dinner here locally in the city of Dearborn. The keynote speaker that night, by the way, there were about 900 people in the room. The keynote speaker that night was Karl Rove. Who never sat down. He walked the entire room, table to table, took as much time as anybody wanted from him. I spent probably 5 to 7 minutes with him, chatting with him. He went around. Every person in that room was personally greeted prior to his getting up to speak by Karl Rove. Talk to me about your boss.
Yes, I should have mentioned that. The Man in the Middle has a wonderful foreword written by Karl Rove. And for a little over 7 years, I was one of Karl's deputies at the White House. I can honestly say, not just in my time in politics, which is, you know, 3 presidential campaigns and 2 U.S. Senate campaigns, but in my entire professional life, I'm quite certain that I have never met anyone like Karl Rove. He is a public intellectual. He is a historian. He is a tactician. And he is a strategist. He plays chess on many levels. In politics, there are men and women who are very gifted tacticians. And in politics, there are very good strategists. But it is rare. In fact, it almost never happens where you have in the same person someone who was both tactician and strategist. And for all of George W. Bush's gifts, which are legion and many and documented in my book, I believe very strongly that Karl Rove is exactly and precisely what George W. Bush called him. He was the architect of the 2000 and the 2004 re-election. It's so easy to forget that in the history of the United States, up until that time, no one ever had gotten more votes than George W. Bush got, 64 million, in 2004. And in large measure, that was because of Karl's remarkable direction in the campaign.
Timothy Gegline is Vice President of External Relations for Focus on the Family. By the way, you can hear Focus on the Family weekday mornings at 9:30 right here on Faith Talk 1500. He served as Deputy Director of the White House Office of Public Liaison under President George W. Bush. His book, which you must read, The Man in the Middle, an inside account of faith and politics in the George W. Bush era. Tim, this has been a fascinating conversation, and I appreciate you sharing it with our audience.
My friend, I promise you, I have done many, 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 many interviews, far more than I can count, and over 100 with regard to this book. I can honestly say this is the most thoughtful and thought-provoking interview I've done, and it's been a pleasure, Paul, to be on with you.
It's been my honor, Tim. Thanks so much. Look forward to chatting with you again.